I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what scientists are starting to understand about COVID-19 and what that tells us about the prospects for a successful vaccine. We'll spend this hour with Dr. Seema Yasmin, Director of Health Communication at Stanford University, who earlier in her career worked as a CDC disease detective. We'll talk about how long COVID immunity might last for people who get sick, about new insights into everyday behaviors that are relatively safe or unsafe in light of the pandemic, and about what the next couple of years might look like as we come to terms with our vulnerability. Our conversation starts after a short break. Some studies have been published that show even among people who recover from COVID-19, antibodies start to peter out within months or even weeks of recovery. If those studies are correct, I wonder, do they cast doubt on the possibility of a one-and-done vaccination to protect us all? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Once I started reading about those studies, I couldn't stop wondering how we might manage our lives from here on out if we all vulnerable to infection and reinfection with a disease that is often mild but sometimes quite deadly. The first conversation we had about coronavirus on this show was with Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's an epidemiologist, medical doctor, and science journalist. Previously in her career, she was an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where she investigated disease outbreaks. We talked to her about this on February 11th, the day the virus got its official name from the World Health Organization. There are still lots of unanswered questions since then about the infection, but scientists have made some important discoveries, so we wanted to check back in with Dr. Yasmin for an update. Seema, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. And February 11th feels like it was three decades ago.
Doesn't it? I can't believe
it was this year.
I know. So I know, Seema, only enough about the immune system to understand that it is incredibly complicated. What do we know about the body's natural immune response to COVID-19 infection?
So yes, the immune system is extremely complex. Even immunologists who have studied it for decades will tell you we have so many unanswered questions, Chris. But what we're learning as we study more and more people infected and who've survived COVID-19 is that the antibody response, and antibodies are these proteins that our B cells make in response to an infection. Antibodies are kind of like Y-shaped proteins that can latch on and do different things to a virus, including deactivating it and killing it. What we're learning is that the antibody response might not stick around for a very long time after we've recovered. And although that's disappointing, it's not that out of line with what we understand for other coronaviruses. So thinking back to much more common coronaviruses, like the ones that cause the cold, we get colds year in, year out. Sometimes you may even get two colds in a year. And that's because with some of these common coronaviruses, we get sick once, we develop an immune response, we develop antibodies, and then about 12 weeks later, just 16 weeks later, those antibodies have almost disappeared, and that leaves us vulnerable to reinfection again. And so we're seeing that with the new coronavirus too. Some studies show that maybe 60 to 90 days after infection, the antibody levels are really low. The important thing though there, Chris, is we still don't exactly understand what level of antibodies do you need in your body to this virus for you to be protected against reinfection. In the case of a vaccine, we're already seeing these early studies data coming out, but we can't say that's good news for a vaccine definitely, because we don't know, is that producing enough antibody to protect us? So that still needs to be studied.
So is it possible that prior infection or some kind of vaccine could prime the immune system to help us fight off something like COVID-19, even if we don't have those very specific antibodies anymore?
Potentially, but we just don't know. That remains an unanswered question. And I should say, because I think you're going to hear me say that a few times throughout the next hour that we have unanswered questions, is we are making educated guesses from what we know about other coronaviruses, including SARS and MERS, those two really awful coronaviruses that caused outbreaks 10 and 20 years ago, but also that a process. So we don't have these questions answered yet, but there's a lot of research being done. And one thing that we are seeing some officials and others do is trying to discredit science because of the fact that some scientists are changing their mind from things that we knew a few months ago. And I just want to say that's a really normal and good part of the scientific process that we do change based on the best available and the most recent evidence.
Why is it that certain viruses are good candidates for vaccines and other viruses are not?
So it's to do sometimes with what's on the surface of a virus. What happens with the immune system is it's recognizing something about the virus. And in some cases, you get an infection once with a virus, and you get such a solid immune response with not just antibodies, but with other cells too, like T cells, including killer T cells, which do exactly what their name describes, that can last a lifetime. And that's really an ideal situation. But in other cases, like I described with the common cold caused by four different coronaviruses, you get an immune reaction that kind of wears off and leaves you vulnerable after just 3 or 4 months. I've been doing a lot of digging and trying to like learn more and remind myself more about those basics of the immune system. And as I've been looking through studies from the last 10 or 15 years, just again about why is it that some viruses cause a really robust immune response and some don't. We actually still just don't fully understand that in the context of immunology. So even that is still being elucidated.
So, on the one hand, we're hearing that immunity may not last very long. On the other hand, we've been hearing promising news in the past few days that some vaccines being tested at least seem to cause people to develop temporarily some antibodies to COVID-19. The first stage, if I understand this correctly, in human testing, Seema, is to ensure that vaccines don't cause harm, right? So, how does that kind of testing play out?
Oh, absolutely. And this is really important because we keep hearing these early data being presented, and it's good to know exactly what they can teach us and what they can't teach us. So, in the first phase of a where an experimental vaccine is being tested in humans, you're only recruiting a few dozen people, if that, Chris. They're healthy volunteers. And what you're doing in phase one is really just a safety trial. Is this vaccine that we're experimenting with causing any terrible side effects? What dose seems to be the best tolerated? Then you get to phase two, where you recruit maybe a few hundred people. So it's still not that much of a bigger trial, but you're expanding who you're testing it in, again, looking out for safety and again, looking out for optimal dosing. Now, of course, you will look for an antibody response because you're curious. You want to know whether you're seeing some kind of immune response in phase one and phase two, but it's only phase three when you're recruiting thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, that you're really getting that data about does this vaccine work or does it not work. So these early data that we're getting, we saw a bunch of stuff come out yesterday, much more about safety and tells us about what dose can be tolerated, cannot tell us if the vaccine will work or not. It gives us some indications as to whether antibodies are developed and what level of antibodies is developed.
So, when you're testing just for safety in those phase one and phase two trials, what exactly are scientists looking for that would indicate that a vaccine formulation might be unsafe? What are some bad things that could happen, with a formulation that somehow just isn't right?
So, you have a kind of a spectrum everywhere, everything from we gave the vaccine and some people had a red spot on their arm. Maybe for a day and then it went away. They took Tylenol and it went away. Maybe some people have a headache or fever, as we learned with the University of Oxford vaccine when they shared data yesterday. But it can go all the way to a very severe, even deathly reaction. We haven't learned of anything excessively severe with any of these experimental COVID-19 vaccines. But of course, there's always the potential for anaphylactic shock, right? For someone to have a really severe reaction to a vaccine. And that's why you're doing these early phase one trials with just a few dozen people and not very many people at all.
So this is one reason that experts are cautioning we can't just railroad this through and get it done overnight. You can't speed up this kind of testing because you have to know that something's safe before you recommend it to people.
We have to be really careful, but we are rushing it. We are doing things that aren't typically done in vaccine development. For example, doing phase one and phase two concurrently, doing testing in humans and in animals at the same time. So some of this is unprecedented in some ways. The timeline is very much being condensed. We're doing what can take decades sometimes in just a few months or in a year or two, we're hoping. To my mind, the fastest that we've ever developed a vaccine before was for mumps, and that took 4 years. So we are doing things a lot quicker now, but that does not mean that anything to do with safety can be minimized. We can't cut corners, because what is the point of making millions of doses of a vaccine if it has the potential to hurt people? We do not want a situation where that happens.
So let's say we get to a place where scientists have determined that a vaccine formulation appears to be safe for people who are trying it. Then you want to see how well it works. Obviously, since we don't have guaranteed treatments to sort of stop the COVID-19 virus in its tracks, you can't just give people the vaccine and then expose them deliberately. So how does that work? Do you just tell people who are part of this study, go out and live your lives and let us know if you develop COVID-19?
So you can do both things, actually. In the phase three, when you're recruiting thousands or tens of thousands of people, you're vaccinating them and then saying, go forth into the real world. Let's see if you get exposed. And ideally, you're doing it in places that have really bad outbreaks. So Arizona, Texas, Georgia might be good places. Right now, some of the vaccine developers are testing the experimental vaccines in places like Brazil and South Africa, which have really bad epidemics. But you can do what we call a challenge trial, which is you give somebody a vaccine and then you actually give them a dose of virus as well. And then in that case, you're not just saying, hey, go home and come back in a few weeks. You're talking to that person every day, if not a few times a day. But what challenge trials can do is even more, they can speed up the process of vaccine development, because you're really seeing quickly, okay, we gave you the vaccine, we gave you some virus. Did it protect you or did it not? And it can just help us get that data a lot quicker.
Many experts think that if one successful vaccine formulation is developed, there will likely be multiple formulations. What are the benefits of having more than one kind of vaccine against the same disease available?
So at the moment, there are about 165 COVID-19 vaccines in being experimented on, and about 26 that are being tested in humans. The way that these 165 different experimental vaccines work is quite different. Some of them are using quite old school technology. Some of them are using much newer, never before approved technology. The benefit to having potentially more than one vaccine available and vaccines that work in different ways is they might stimulate the immune system in different ways. So we talk a lot about antibodies, but we can also have vaccines that stimulate our T cells and our B cells a lot more. So maybe we end up in a situation where we have a few vaccines available that work maybe in different ways, and maybe some are more effective in some groups versus others. I was even thinking yesterday when the University of Oxford released its early data, they'd only tested the vaccine in people ages 18 to 55. They're now going to also look at older adults, but I was thinking, well, I'm really worried about older adults because they're more vulnerable to severe COVID. But also we know from looking back with other vaccines, but older people sometimes don't develop a strong immune response from vaccines. So maybe we end up with some vaccines that work better in older people, some that work better in younger. It just gives us more options in our toolkit against this virus.
Can a vaccine accidentally trigger the kind of cytokine storm that we know is a major risk to people who develop COVID-19?
There is that potential, and that's why you see those few people recruited in early stages of this testing, and that's why you see people monitored really, really carefully. Of course, the thing that you are trying to do with a vaccine is mimic natural infection. So those same things that can happen with infection could potentially happen with a vaccine. You'd hope the chances are way low because of how much research and how much studying we do to make sure that the immune system does not go into overdrive. But that possibility is always there, and that's why there should be such rigorous safety monitoring of everyone who's enrolled in a clinical trial.
If, for the sake of argument, a successful vaccine were to be created and approved, how long might it take to be mass-produced in the quantities that the world will need?
So really important question, because historically, even when you end up with something that works fantastically in your clinical trials and in your lab, it can be a number of years and many millions of dollars before you can create from a small batch, hundreds of millions of doses. And we've already seen the US government talk about Operation Warp Speed, talk about having 300 million doses, potentially, of a safe and effective vaccine available by January 2021. What we are seeing now to try and deal with that issue is as vaccines are being developed lab and being tested in humans, there are manufacturing and logistical conversations happening about how can we mass produce, how can we scale up, and there are people telling us that that might be possible.
My guest is Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's an epidemiologist and a medical doctor, also a science journalist. We're talking this hour about what we know and don't know about COVID-19. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we're talking about what we know at this point and still don't know about COVID-19 with epidemiologist, medical doctor, and science journalist Dr. Seema Yasmin. All right, Seema, I want to talk about what we know at this point about transmission. Some people have been frustrated by conflicting advice over time about masks. Here is Anthony Fauci, March 8th on 60 Minutes.
The masks are important for someone who's infected to prevent them from infecting someone else. Now, when you see people and look at the films in China and South Korea, whatever, everybody's wearing a mask. Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
You're sure of it? Because people are listening really closely to this.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask.
That was what he said March 8th. And here he is July 17th. He had changed his mind on this.
And I think, you know, one of the important things that we're emphasizing right now that really evolved from a situation that did change is our insistence now on wearing masks. I mean, masks are very important. They protect you from giving infection to someone else. If you happen to be inadvertently infected, and I'll get back to that in a moment, because there's such a significant percentage of the cases that are actually without symptoms.
All right, give us some context on this. Did Fauci understand, Seema, do you think, that the benefits of masks early on still existed, but he wanted to save PPE that was necessary for medical workers?
So two things I would say here. First is that science isn't just a bunch of static facts. It's this shifting knowledge base. It's this process of discovery. So our understanding of this virus and of transmission, of course, it's evolved over the last few months. It's only been about 7 months that we've known about it. But the second point is that science does not operate in a vacuum. So somebody like Dr. Fauci is giving guidance and giving advice about policy based not just on what we understand about transmission, but also contending with the fact that in February, March, April, the United States had critical shortages of PPE. So Dr. Fauci has, of course, been asked about his earlier comments, and he has said that there were concerns that frontline workers just would not have the most basic equipment that they needed to protect themselves, to not die on the job. And that's why there was concern that if we told people you need to wear a mask, in the US, people would go out and buy very limited supplies of what was available and needed to be conserved for healthcare workers. And of course, we have seen about 85,000 healthcare workers infected in the US over the last few months, and about 1,000 died from COVID-19, many of their family states, because they could not get the right PPE. So I think those two things factor into his shifting messaging from earlier in the year to much more recently.
So we can now buy cloth masks at Old Navy and Target and Walmart. To the extent that masks work, are these cloth ones good enough for most of us?
Well, they do reduce the droplets that we can breathe out or speak out when we're singing, talking, laughing, breathing, all of those things. So we do know that even with those most rudimentary kind of masks, there is a benefit in terms of keeping your droplets in and also protecting you from other people's respiratory secretions as well.
So, of course, we have all, most of us have been taught since childhood that we should be washing our hands frequently. The advice on avoiding COVID now seems to focus much more on facial coverings. Are we more likely to catch the virus by breathing it in somehow than by touching a contaminated object and then touching our faces?
Yeah, so the World Health Organization does believe that the biggest risk and the biggest driver of transmission in this pandemic is when you are breathing in droplets from somebody else. And they could also go into your eyes, nose, or mouth and get into your body and airways in that way. Of course, there's been a big debate in the last week or two about airborne versus droplet transmissions. Maybe we can clear that up because the language and the terminology is frustratingly confusing. But a lot of this debate, those 239 scientists from 32 countries that wrote that letter to the World Health Organization saying, hey, please acknowledge this is airborne. What they were talking about was that so far, The World Health Organization has been saying that we're at risk of infection from droplets. These are droplets that are about 5 microns big, so they're tiny, but they're quite heavy at 5 microns, meaning that if I'm talking, the droplet might shoot out but not travel more than 6 feet. Because of its weight, it's just going to drop to the floor. What these scientists were saying is that that's happening, but also we're producing particles and droplets that are smaller than that. And if they're smaller, they're lighter, they can travel further, maybe they can even hang in the air. So again, our understanding of this virus and how it spreads has been shifting almost day by day.
Okay, we've all been curious as to why some people get COVID-19, get barely sick at all, some people get very severely ill. What might the relationship be between the dose of the virus we're exposed to and the extent to which we become ill?
So different pathogens, including bacteria and viruses, have different infectious doses, meaning exactly how much do you need to be exposed to get infected? And then is there a dose-response relationship? With this new coronavirus, we're still learning exactly what that might be. And if there is a relationship, intuitively you would think if you get sneezed on, really close proximity, say you're exposed to a lot of virus, wouldn't that be worse than if it was just a few droplets? The tricky thing, though, is that how we get sick is an interplay between the virus and our bodies, how we respond to that. So maybe in some people, it might be a situation where they only need to be exposed to very little virus, but there's something about their immune system, there's something about their genetics that makes them more susceptible. So again, we are 7 months into understanding this virus and still trying to answer these questions, especially in the context of kids. So many kids seem to get infected but not actually get sick. And then we see some kids, a minority, get really, really sick, have this massive immune response that lands them in the ICU, and we don't fully understand why that is.
Recently, some small studies suggested blood type might play a factor in our susceptibility to COVID-19. Put those in perspective for us. Are the data definitive enough to say that people like with O-type blood might be better off than people with A-type blood, or did the reporting on those studies jump the gun based on what scientists actually know?
Yeah, the reporting sadly did jump the gun, and I think we're vulnerable to a lot of that right now because we're seeing data published as preprints, meaning it hasn't gone through that rigorous peer review process just yet, Chris. But it has been debunked, and there's a good study and a report from researchers at Harvard who say there's no correlation between your blood type and how severely sick you might get from COVID-19.
Mary is calling us from Ennis, Texas. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi,
I'm happy to be here today. I survived it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Mary. That's great.
Mm-hmm. You and me. So my question is, what kind of entity do I contact to find out where I can donate blood?
Oh, for the antibodies. Okay.
Yeah.
Where do you suggest she go, Seema?
Hi, Mary. I'm so glad that you survived. And yes, for people wondering what you're referring to, what we're learning, as we have with many other infections previous to COVID-19, is that the blood of survivors can be very helpful to those who are sick with COVID-19 because the blood of survivors can contain these antibodies that may have helped them fight off the infection and could help other people. I think your best bet for understanding where you might be able to donate the plasma to locally is to contact local hospitals because they'll be the ones coordinating those blood draws. And I do know of people who have managed to do that. They found it quite straightforward. They had to answer some questions over the phone with a nurse and then make an appointment and then go and donate their blood. And in some cases, they've even been told how many people after the fact received their antibodies and may have benefited from it. But the best bet is to contact your local healthcare providers because they'll have that information for you.
I've been really interested in this ongoing research to understand why some people seem to spread COVID to very large numbers of other people and others hardly spread it at all. What might be different about so-called super spreaders? Is that about biology or behavior or location or some combination of all those things?
So first off, I like to talk more about super spreading events because sometimes I think that term super spreaders can stigmatize people and that the last thing we want in the context of an infectious disease is people feeling really bad about themselves or feeling so ashamed that they're not going to get help or talk to contact tracers, for example. But I mean, you're fine to use that term because we've been using it for many years in infectious disease. I'm just trying to be really careful about the language and the power of language. But in the case of these super spreading events, what we're seeing, and we've seen this with other infections too, is it might be that about 20% of people are responsible for 80% of infections. And it could be, again, this complex interplay of many things. Is it because of that person's biology? Is it their immune system? Is it the way that the virus is able to replicate really efficiently inside them that makes them able to infect many people? Or is it something about their life? Is it that they are really social? Is it that they live with many people? Is it something to do with their immune system? Is it to do with their access to healthcare? So all of those things play a role. And to be honest, even preceding this pandemic, we were still struggling to understand how super spreading events occur. We saw them with SARS and MERS, and we don't fully understand it.
What are the best hypotheses for why, at least in this country, people of color seem at such greater risk for illness from COVID-19 and for severe effects and even death?
So sadly, it has everything to do with racism, the impact that racism has on your body, the impact it has on your life, your access to healthcare. Many more people of color in the U.S. live in areas that we define as health deserts, meaning that there's not good access to providers, to nurses. This is a long-standing issue, Chris, that's kind of getting more attention now during the pandemic, but it's not new. We see higher rates of death from cancers in people of color with pandemic flu, the H1N1 flu that happened about 10 years ago. We saw really high rates, like 4, 5, 6 times higher rates of infection among American Indian people compared to their white peers. So it's really to do with the structural institutional impacts of racism, the fact that Black people, when they go to see a doctor, are far less likely to have their symptoms believed. They're more likely to have painkillers withheld from them. There's a lot of evidence that shows us exactly how medical institutions shortchange people of color and how that leads to worse outcomes from health, including death.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Joe calling us from Haltom City. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question was, given we have the vaccine by some end of the year, but it only protects us for about 6 months, is there any way they can change the formulation to extend the life of the vaccine?
Thanks for calling.
That's a really good question. I'm so glad you asked that, because here's the thing. When we think about developing vaccines, we're trying to mimic a natural infection, right? Without having to put somebody through the horrors of a natural infection, you give them a vaccine instead. But even though what we're learning about antibodies and immunity to COVID-19, even though that can seem a bit depressing at the moment, although we're still needing to study it more, it doesn't necessarily mean bad news for a vaccine. And here's why. Sometimes vaccines can give you a more robust, a stronger and longer lasting immune response compared to a natural infection. So already, even though it's early days, and I'll always remind us of that, we are seeing with some of these experimental vaccines that the antibody levels in people who receive the vaccine are about 2 to 3 times higher than the antibody levels you see in someone who's naturally infected and who recovered from COVID-19. So just because we're learning this bad news about the virus and antibodies to the virus doesn't necessarily mean that we'll see the same thing with the vaccine. It might be a situation, though, where you get one shot of a vaccine and then you may need to go back a month or a few months later for a booster. That would not be ideal because the logistics of that are terrible, but maybe that's what we're facing.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I mean, at this point, Seema, an effective vaccine of any kind is really like kind of the holy grail that a lot of people are hoping for. And yet, in this country, there is still significant resistance to vaccines among some Americans, despite long track records for vaccinations in protecting human health. What do you think it would take to help people who are afraid right now to trust the science on this?
Yeah, you know, we don't even have an approved vaccine yet. We don't even have a vaccine that works, but already we have tens of thousands of anti-vaccine messages circulating on social media for a non-existent vaccine. And as you're saying, Chris, there are multiple surveys where Americans have been asked, if there was a vaccine available today that had the potential to end the pandemic, would you take it? And in some cases, 50% of people in these surveys are saying that they would refuse. I think this is not a new problem. It's something I've been studying and tracking for a long time in the context of measles vaccines and whooping cough vaccines. It's not a new problem, but we need to take it very seriously in public health and not just be focused on the spread of the disease when the spread of misinformation and disinformation about the disease and the vaccine is just as deadly. I think what can help is to be really transparent about the process and to say, hands up, we are doing this faster than we've ever done it in history, but let us take you behind the scenes so you understand what's happening at each step of the way. I also think we need to be very sophisticated in our messaging, because sometimes in public health and medicine, Chris, we get kind of very in our heads and a bit prideful about the fact that we are armed with facts and science and evidence, but that doesn't always translate to stories that are compelling or believable or entertaining even, whereas the anti-vaccine messages are often very emotionally triggering, very shareable, very memorable, so that the anti-science messaging is sometimes better storytelling than what we do in science, and we really need to improve that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go next on the phone to Alan in Grapevine, Texas. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Back in the 70s when I was with the 82nd Airborne and I was a medic, we had to do our 2 or 3 weeks tour of duty during the flu season at the clinic. And the doctor who ran that clinic made everybody wear masks and gloves and all that. But he also told everybody that vitamin C was instrumental in making... recommendation was 5,000 milligrams a day, and he made everybody take that, and I do it to this day.
Well, Seema, does that work? Has vitamin C been proven to help us fight infection?
I mean, there are actually some recent studies that show that large doses of vitamins while people are recovering could even be harmful. But I think the thing to remember, Alan, is that you don't want people to get a false sense of security from taking something like vitamin C, which is not proven to protect against COVID-19, because the fear is that someone takes a supplement, whether it's vitamin C or some other supplement, and believes that they are now protected, that they are now immune, and then they might put themselves and other people at risk of infection. It's hard to keep up with the science. I will surely admit that, because every day we're hearing about something new. But I worry about this with every epidemic, Chris, that every contagion, there are multiple snake oil salesmen selling us things, whether it's colloidal silver or some other thing, or whether it's just touting garlic or vitamin C. The World Health Organization, I think, is doing a better job than it has done in previous epidemics of kind of debunking these. So its website is actually a good one to go to if you hear something like that, because they're debunking some of these myths.
My guest is Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's a medical doctor, epidemiologist, and science journalist. We're talking about what we do and don't know right now about COVID-19. My guest this hour is Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's a medical doctor and epidemiologist, also a science journalist. We're talking today about what we know and don't know about COVID-19 at this point in our history. Just before the break, Seema, you mentioned, you know, wanting to avoid getting a false sense of security. I think as we, you know, talk about how to manage school reopenings and other kinds of businesses reopening, people are talking about daily fever checks for people who come in. Now, I wouldn't object to that kind of check, but I wonder how often a fever check actually catches somebody who otherwise might not realize they are sick, or how useful something like a fever check is if someone's feeling fine.
Yeah, so this has also been changing the more we understand this virus, because now we're learning that there are many people, different percentages depending on which study you look at, who actually get COVID-19, get sick even, but don't develop the fever. So certainly, if you were looking out for that as a symptom, then you might miss large groups of people who are infected, but that's just not been their body's response to it. Even with earlier infections of other viruses, sometimes fever checks are found to not be very effective at detecting enough cases. And so some countries, I think Israel is one of them, have kind of just done away with this idea of a fever check. Also because somebody could mask it by taking Tylenol and forget they've taken it and then pass the fever check but actually be infected. But maybe like questionnaires asking people about things like loss of sense, of smell, loss of taste, maybe those could be more effective ways of actually monitoring who's infected and who's.
What have we learned in the past 6 months about the best ways to care for people who have active cases of COVID-19?
So we've seen experimental treatments as well as older treatments come back and be kind of useful for this new virus. So one that we've learned about is remdesivir, this antiviral that was the first one in the U.S. to get emergency use authorization for treating COVID-19. Remdesivir is actually a failed Ebola drug and a failed hepatitis C drug, which does seem to help people with COVID-19 if they're already severely sick and already in hospital. What remdesivir does is it seems to decrease the recovery time from an average of 15 days to an average of 11 days, so lessens it by about 4 days. We've also seen dexamethasone, which is not new at all. It's been around for decades. It's quite a cheap and readily available steroid. That's proven to be useful for people, again, who are severely ill. So there are other experimental treatments that are also being investigated. But again, we're seeing that about 80% of people who get the virus either don't have any symptoms at all, so they're completely asymptomatic, or they get symptoms that are so mild that they're not requiring treatment and they're just recuperating at home.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Fred calling from Austin. Hi, Fred.
Hello. I'm curious whether or not anybody has noticed folks that are on the retroviral, the PrEP-type medications to prevent catching HIV, if that is a little, like a little check mark for people, you're like, is that protection or is that have no consequence?
Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
Ooh. That's a great question. So PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And in the context of HIV, it's a pill that people can take once a day, and it protects you even if you get exposed to HIV. I don't know if anyone's seen if that works for COVID-19. On the one hand, I want to say to you, well, this is a really different virus to HIV, right? Why would the same medicine work? But then I just told you about remdesivir, which was initially developed for hepatitis C and Ebola, didn't work for those, but does seem to offer some kind of help for the new coronavirus. So I don't know if anyone's looked into PrEP. I love the idea of PrEP, though. I wish the PrEP existed for every infection, because there's this idea that you can take something that protects you even if in the future you become infected.
I read an article yesterday, and I don't know if you've encountered this, about a British study of an inhaled form of interferon that seems to prevent the illness from getting very bad among people who are hospitalized with COVID-19. I realize it's too early to get excited about that, but can you explain what interferon is and why doctors might have thought to try it on COVID patients?
Yeah, so interferon is a chemical that our immune system makes to fight off infections. Actually, interferon is the culprit for when we get flu and we start to feel really crappy because it's hard at work. And so interferon is what makes us feel really tired and it can make us more feverish and all of that awful stuff. But it's doing that in its fight against infection. What we think the new coronavirus does, though, is that it might be suppressing our body's interferon production. So that's why scientists have said, let's try an inhaled version of interferon. It's been around for a long time. We used to use it in patients with hepatitis C, for example. And there's some early studies that show it might be promising, but it's too early to say that conclusively, Chris. And I see also a lot of critiques of that existing data about interferon, but I am keeping a close eye on it.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Patrick in Bedford, Texas. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is, my mother is a retired hospital pharmacy director, and I've had numerous conversations with her about the virus and the potential vaccines. And one of the things that she mentioned to me was that in a literature she's read that there seems to be an Asian strain and a European strain. And I'm curious if there's any other evidence to suggest that there are other mutations or that there might be future mutations in which the virus has yet to become yet.
Thanks for calling.
So the idea that viruses evolve and mutate is not a new one. It's not surprising because viruses are constantly replicating inside us when we get infected, making more copies of themselves. And as they do so, they can kind of slip up and make mistakes that introduce genetic changes. What we've learned so far, I think, with the new coronavirus is there are two types where there's a very tiny genetic change that makes one version of the coronavirus that is more infectious, we think. There are also critiques of that study because it's still early days. But the interesting thing is, even if that virus that's mutated a little bit does seem to be more infectious, it doesn't seem to cause much more severe illness. and it doesn't seem to increase the rate of hospitalizations in areas where that version of the virus is spreading versus the other one. So scientists are definitely checking this because we want to see how quickly is the virus evolving, is it evolving to types that are much more dangerous, but so far what we're understanding is that there might be a version that's a bit more infectious, but not necessarily more lethal.
Yeah, I would think from the perspective of the virus, and I realize that the way evolution happens and mutations happen, it's no one's decision, obviously, but mm-hmm. I would think it would be more advantageous to the virus to be, to sort of, infect more people without them even knowing they're sick. So they're going about their lives. They continue to transmit it to people who don't know that they're infected. Is there a possibility that the virus could change in that direction so that it remains quite contagious, but it makes people less often quite severely ill?
Well, I think one of the biggest blows, maybe this is just my perspective, but was that time when we realized that so much of the transmission that was happening from people that felt completely fine. Mm. I remember when that data started emerging about asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic transmission, my heart sank at that time when I thought, oh no, this makes it so much harder to get an epidemic under control. It makes it so much harder to do contact tracing. That was the point when I thought we really, really have our work cut out for us, because now we're not just dealing with a situation like with SARS 18 years ago, where people got infected, sure, but then they got really sick. So they were at home or they were in hospital. They just weren't exposed to too many people. With this new coronavirus, people are walking around and spreading the infection to others because they're just not realizing that they are contagious. And because we live in the U.S. where testing is at one third of the level that it needs to be at to really be detecting cases. So I would say in that sense, Chris, the virus already has the upper hand.
Who ought to be tested if we had unlimited capacity in this country, Seema, that probably isn't being tested now? Is it a matter of not enough places where people can go? Is it people not being recommended for testing when, in fact, they could benefit from it?
We've seen so many slip-ups and mistakes in the U.S. in the context of testing, everything from back in February, the CDC sending out these faulty tests to states, to the CDC giving these way too narrow guidelines and criteria for who should be tested. Where we're at right now is we're doing about 720,000 tests a day, but researchers at Harvard who have been crunching the numbers say we need to be doing a bare minimum of 2.1 million tests every day. And they say bare minimum because we would need to be doing 2.1 million tests a day just to lower viral spread. They say that for us to actually suppress viral spread and start those D numbers really, really go down towards zero, we need to be doing 4 million tests a day. The guidance is that testing should be available definitely for everybody with symptoms and for 10 additional people to be tested for every one confirmed case. We are so far from that in the U.S., and to be really frank with you, that frightens me because I think of how hellish the last few months have been, and without us ramping up testing to where it needs to be now, we may have a really hellish 5, 6, 7 months ahead of us because testing is so critical. We're not even saying everyone should be able to get testing, even asymptomatic people. Ideally, that would be the case that you could fall fine and just easily get a test. But we're seeing a situation in the States where there are people who have symptoms who are waiting 9, 10 hours to get a test, Chris, and then are waiting around 2 weeks to get a result back. Really, from a public health perspective, anything beyond a 3-day test turnaround is really detrimental to the pandemic response.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go next on the phone to Larry. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. So I'm a licensed dietitian, and what I've been wondering is, since we still haven't addressed the vitamin D deficiencies, which half the population, you know, is deficient, and we're getting ready to send teachers back out, you know, into the schools, as well as have parents be exposed to the kids, wouldn't it be prudent to fix those vitamin D deficiencies? And would that impact the, their outcomes or their severity possibly of the disease?
Well, thank you for your call, Larry. What do you know, Seema? Is vitamin D deficiency associated with risk of COVID-19 infection?
So, Chris, actually, the evidence is really slim about any correlation or connection between vitamin D deficiency and risk of infection with COVID-19 or risk of developing severe COVID-19. There's been a lot of studies, there's been a lot of disagreement in the scientific community, but myself and many others I've interviewed believe there's just not enough evidence, not enough robust evidence to say that there's a connection. So in the context of school reopening, I'm way more worried about a lack of testing, lack of PPE, lack of disinfectant wipes, lack of training for teachers and for students and parents, much more than I am about vitamin D levels, to be honest.
How are you keeping in touch with colleagues of yours who are actively working to care for people with COVID-19, and how serious has the toll been on colleagues?
People are talking about leaving the profession and not like bailing during the pandemic, but people are having serious conversations about whether they want to practice medicine in the U.S. moving forward, because two things are happening. One, doctors are being, and nurses and all kinds of healthcare professionals are being put on the front lines without the right PPE, without the most basic things that they need to do their job without losing or risking their life. But the other thing that we're seeing on a really widespread level is we go to medical school, we do PhDs, we train in science, all of that to be told during a pandemic that none of it matters, that science doesn't matter, that scientists are being discredited, journalism is being discredited at the same time. All of that is very disheartening, and I'm worried that even before the pandemic, we were talking about epidemics of burnout amongst healthcare providers. That's only getting worse now. We've already seen suicides of healthcare workers during the pandemic, some of them telling their family members they can't cope with the trauma that they're seeing and the lack of support that they're receiving. So I'm really worried about this crisis in mental health and in physical health amongst healthcare workers. And I wonder how sustainable it is and what the long-term impact will be on the profession.
How have you changed the way you go about your daily life since this virus started spreading in the U.S.?
I'm really sad a lot more. I'm really angry. I mean, just from a human level, when I see the things that the president tells Americans, when I see the lies, when I see people like Dr. Fauci being bullied and attacked and discredited, it makes me really question why I live in America, and I choose to live here because I love it. And I say this as a Brit who left England very specifically to train in public health at the CDC, because based on all my research, the CDC was the place to train in epidemiology, was the place to do public health. And what we've seen over the last few months is that that agency, literally the website, the pages from the website go dark, data go disappearing from the CDC website, the agency being silenced and sidelined and discredited. And it just really makes me worry about public health and the future of public health in the U.S.
Dr. Seema Yasmin is an epidemiologist, medical doctor, and science journalist. Earlier in her career, she was working for the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Seema, it's always nice to speak with you. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you for your brilliant questions. Thanks for having me again.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and you'll never have to miss a show. Or if you like, listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.